Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Nicholas E. Brink, who is the author of The Power of Aesthetic Trance, Practices for Healing, Spiritual Growth, and Assessing the Universal Mind. Dr. Brink is a psychologist. He is on the board of directors of the International Association for Study of Dreams. He is a past president of the American Association for Study of Mental Imaging, and he gives teaches in aesthetic trance with the Philetus Goodman Institute. Welcome, Dr. Brink. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I was fascinated by your book. I had not really had any experiences with aesthetic trance other than drumming circles.
Uh-huh.
And I had been led through a weird group of circumstances to go to a drumming in St. John's Island, and I found I couldn't even drum. I was trying to drum, but instead I was up as an eagle flying. I was flying above everything. I was totally out of my body, flying above the drumming circle. It was a very large drumming circle.
Wow, great.
And
you were having an ecstatic trance right there.
There I was, without even trying. So I'm going to definitely try your trance positions in this book.
Uh-huh.
I think this is fascinating. And what a great way to understand what you're working on spiritually and then tap into the energy field so that you can the universe can help you do the healing and the waking up that you want to do. It's great.
Great.
So tell us a little bit about how you, as a psychologist, discovered the entire, visualization and then eventually into trance work.
Okay. I'm a semi-retired now. I was a psychologist for about 30 years, and
mm-hmm.
one of my primary modes of therapy was hypnosis, clinical hypnosis. And in doing a hypnosis, to induce a trance, you talk in a slow voice. I usually would watch the person I was leading into a trance and talk in the rhythm of their breathing rate. And then there's a lot of other hypnotic techniques to lead them into a trance. But it was me doing a lot of the talking and a lot of the planning and making a lot of the suggestions. I mean, it was a shared experience, but still, I was the one that was vocalizing the suggestions to the client. Then, when I was president of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery, I was organizing a national conference, and someone in the organization said I needed to invite Felicitas Goodman to be our keynote speaker, and I didn't know who she was. But I did invite her, and she agreed to come. But then everything went wrong, and the printers didn't get the brochures out, and the conference was canceled. But I did read her book, and I did talk to her on the phone. And in reading her book, I was just fascinated by it. It was another way of inducing trance. Then in 2007, at the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference, I offered a workshop on ecstatic trance, and that was the first time I ever even tried using it. For some reason, I didn't even do it on my own. And you mentioned a drumming circle. Before I offered my first workshop at the conference, we had a drumming circle, and I sat in the back of the room in one of the postures, and actually a shape-shifting posture. And mm-hmm. I very quickly became a horse. And in this particular case, I was a parade horse, a high-stepping parade horse. And afterwards, I realized that the person that was closest to me drumming was drumming in a real parade-like cadence. And I asked mm-hmm. him afterwards, I mentioned to him afterwards what had happened, and he laughed, and he said, well, he had been in a college band for many years, and that's the way he would drum.
Mm-hmm.
But that was then at the workshop, I had like 14 people in it, and I was just really amazed at how what Felicitas Goodman said would happen, happened. And so I came home and I started a group, and I've been doing it ever since 2007. What is unique about Goodman's work is she discovered that particular postures have particular effects on a trance experience. Mm-hmm. I'll get more into that in just a minute, but just to tell you a little bit about Goodman, she came from Hungary as a linguist. She had got her degree in linguistics in Hungary and could speak like 20 languages. So she was very popular on college campuses to translate literature from different languages into English. And when she was at Denison University in Ohio, she met this one professor who was an anthropologist who was studying ecstatic trance in like 183 different primitive cultures around the world. Ecstatic trance was induced by the stimulation of the nervous system, usually by a drum beat or by dancing steps or by hand clapping or by shaking of a rattle. There was a stimulation to the body that would lead a person into trance. What Goodman did for her dissertation is she studied speaking in tongues, and she was curious about how, in apostolic churches, she was curious how that would, in how that trance was induced. She went to some apostolic churches in Mexico where they spoke in Spanish, some where they spoke in Mayan, and also the English-speaking churches, and she studied what about the church service induced trance. And she concluded that first there was a sacred quiet place, the church, that you had the expectation that you're going to have an extraordinary experience. You had also the belief that the experience was going to be healthy and normal. In the case of the church, that you're going to be possessed by the Holy Spirit. And then there was the rhythmic stimulation. In the church, it was usually hand clapping or the music. And so she brought those four elements back home to Denison University to her students and used them to induce trance in the students. And she found that it worked, but something was missing. She felt that there was no organization to their trance experiences. Then she read this article by this Canadian psychologist who studied different meditation postures and how the meditation postures had effects on the body in terms of heart rate, breathing rate, bowel motility, skin conductivity. And for her, a light went on. She thought, wow, the posture has an effect. So she went back to primitive art and also ancient primitive art and found what she thought were 40 or 50 different shamanic postures that shaman used in going into their experiences. And she started using these postures, and this was the turning point. This is what came up with what I was writing about. She discovered that particular postures were for going into your body for healing, this feeling of energy flowing into your body. Other postures were for divination, of finding answers to questions or looking into the future. Some postures were for journeying into the underworld or the middle world or the upper world. And then there was the postures for a metamorphosis or shape-shifting. Then there was the death-rebirth experiences, or what we call initiation postures. And when I first used this, that's what happened. When I used a particular posture, the posture I used in the drumming circle was a shape-shifting posture, and I became a horse. And very consistently, I have found that these postures have that effect on the trance experience. And the book, I have now collected probably from a couple hundred different people, well over 1,000 trance experiences. And that's the content of much of the book, of just giving the stories of how these trance experiences affected a person's life, for causing healing, or for bringing about healing, for spiritual growth, and for going beyond our usual consciousness, when I refer to it as accessing the universal mind, or the collective unconscious, or the going beyond ourselves. So that's sort of a fairly brief summary of where I'm coming from.
Well, we'll talk about the universal mind a little bit later in the interview, but there is evidence that these postures can be spontaneously obtained. There's things in the spiritual literature and workshops where people spontaneously go into different postures, probably because they need the posture in order to bring in the energy or whatever they're achieving during their practice. So
right.
I think it's just really amazing, though, to go back in anthropology and collect the statues and realize that many of the statues that that are in your book are, that's the key to understanding the, that this has been used throughout human history.
The new Native American Museum in Washington, D.C., on the fourth floor, they had this room with one wall covered with figurines or statues from the various areas of the North and South America. There's probably 1,000 of these statues on the wall, and you look over them and you see these postures over and over and over again. Practically every one of the figures is in one of these postures. It was just very impressive. I love to go there and just get a catalog of all those postures and maybe write about them, about the, what's going on at that museum too.
Yeah, really.
But
that's
you mentioned spontaneous. Go ahead. Excuse me.
Oh no, go ahead.
Okay, you mentioned spontaneous. Well, I think your experience of the drumming circle was a spontaneous experience. You weren't thinking about specifically the posture you were in or going into it with any particular thought in mind, but you from the stimulation of your nervous system from the drumming circle, you had that experience, and so. It happens spontaneously. It happens, and you're probably something inside of you was saying you're ready for such an experience. What we
I wasn't thinking about having any of these experiences either. You know, I was trying to concentrate on drumming because you're with a group of people and you're trying to do your part. You know, drumming because everybody's drumming, and then you find you can't drum. It was strange.
Right. But well, we have a ritual. She took it out of the church ritual. She took it away from the apostolic church and created her own ritual, which was a combination of different Native American rituals, or maybe world cultural rituals. We first, in the group, we have a person. Someone comes to the group with the posture they want to use. Usually as the leader, I will suggest it. Sometimes the members of the group suggest a posture. And then I have the group take the posture, and we check it out to make sure that they're holding the posture correctly. Some postures are laying down, some are sitting down, squatting, cross-legged, some are standing. And Then we create our sacred space, and we do that first by smudging. We have a bundle of herbs, usually of sage, smoldering, and we sort of brush the smoke from the sage over us. I prefer not to use smoke. I think that's sort of polluting, but I have a abalone shell with a piece of wicking, and I put some oil scent on it so you get the scent, and we just brush the scent over our bodies for cleansing. Then we call the spirits of the six directions, and the medicine wheel concept of first starting with the east, the sunrise, the beginning of life, spring, birth is the east, calling the spirits and asking this with all your wisdom and understanding, join us in this experience. Then from the south, that's summer, that's growth, that's the warmth and the growth of our gardens and in our childhood. The spirits of the south join us. Then the west is the middle age of life. It's fall. It's the harvest of the gardens. And we call the spirits from there. Then the north is the hibernation, the dormancy, our elder years, in preparation for a rebirth in spring. Then we call for the spirits of the sky, the stars, the moon, the sun, and then from Mother Earth. And after we, this defines the whole sacred space and prepares us for the experience. Then we have 5 minutes of silence to where we quiet our minds and we just focus on our breathing. Then I start drumming or shaking the rattle, and or someone in the group does. I usually do it, but sometimes I've used a CD tape of drumming rather than doing it if I didn't want to be distracted by me doing it myself. And we do it for 15 minutes. And then at the end, I have people record their experience. And typically, the what we call it the Cuamungi method. The Cuamungi is the institute in New Mexico. They typically have people just put it in a journal. I have them put it on a 5x7 card. I then collect the cards, and then I enter their experiences on computer files and email them back maybe 4 or 5 days later. I think it's very valuable for them to look at their experience after 4 or 5 days and review it. And I think if they put it in their journal, they just may forget about it. So I have found that that was a very helpful reminder for the continuity of it, and that's where I had collected all these experiences. So we have the Cuamungi. Okay, Felicitas Goodman, back in the 60s, I think it was, bought this piece of land on the Pulaski Pueblo. In New Mexico, there's like 18 different Pueblo Indian pueblos rather than a reservation as such. Well, she leased this land from the Pulaski Pueblo, like a 400 acres, I think it is, and she's built the institute there. She died about 6 years ago, but it's about 14 miles north of Santa Fe. And to me, it's become a very beautiful spiritual place to go. And I've been going there every summer for a couple of weeks during the summer just to be part of the institute. But it's out of that program at the institute, we've created this particular ritual. Though that doesn't mean that the ritual is the only way of doing it. You could create your own ritual, I think, as long as you have these expectations of the experience.
So do you think doing the same posture in a group is a more powerful experience than doing it alone, or do you think it doesn't matter?
I think it matters. I think the group experience is that group contagion. It becomes much more vivid. And for a newcomer, it was very interesting. I did this one of our local colleges, Juniata College, I forgot to think of it for a moment. I did a group of about 40 seniors at this in this college, and their experiences were very, I hate to use the word shallow, that's sort of negative, but they weren't as developed as a lot of the other experiences. They felt warmth, they felt their body swaying, they felt coldness, they felt like they were going to fall over. They had a lot of physical responses. And I would point out to them, if you let your imagination go, if you feel like you're swaying, what is pushing you or what is pulling you? If you feel yourself getting hot, where is the heat coming from? Use your imagination to let go. When I did it with the Dream Association, I think that's why it worked, I think, so well, is because dreamers, people that collect their dreams, are very much in touch with altered states of consciousness, with their dream experience.
Right.
And they were so much more visual. Open. They were so much more open to having these stories, you know, than the college students were. But the college group I did it with, after several weeks, I think I had four of them continue for the next 12 weeks with me. And after the third or fourth session, their experiences really did develop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's a great way for people to actually get more out of the communication between themselves and their subconscious, themselves and their superconscious. And then, you know, the really important thing is that they can have a path of what to work on next. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the concept that spiritual growth is not a belief system. It's an experiential task. I mean, you don't really get a lot by reading a bunch of books on spirituality. You actually have to do things, and this might really appeal to people who may not have time for dream journaling. You know, dream journaling is really wonderful, but it does take time. And people who prefer meditation may prefer the trance work that you're doing as kind
group,
of a waking
dream. The
group really
does add to that. I mean, yes, I mean, after you learn how to do this and after you have some good experiences, I do it most every day myself, by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I have quite a few people in the group do it by themselves after they've discovered the value of it. But if you just do it by yourself from the beginning, sometimes your experience is sort of meaningless at first, and so you just give up and don't try. That's one of the reasons why I like to have people begin with the group.
So tell us a little bit about, I'm sure you have a website and some information on the trainings you do.
Okay. When I first got going, I had no mentor, I had nobody I was learning from except reading the books. Reading Felicitas Goodman's Where the Spirits Ride the Wind is her book, her main book. She's written a bunch of other books, but that's the main book describing ecstatic trance. Then Belinda Gore, G-O-R-E, has written two books on ecstatic trance, and hers are more workbooks. And it so happened that after I did this for several months, I got a hold of Belinda Gore's email address, and I emailed her. I had a couple questions. Oh, and she was so great at getting back to me and making suggestions and being critical. So one of her very first criticisms is I was referring to these experiences we were having as dreamlike experiences. And she says, no, call them ecstatic experiences. She sort of corrected my language. She says, they're not dreaming as such. Yes, they are like dreams, but it's different. So she was very good. And she, after we communicated for a while, she said, I need to go through the teacher's training. And she was in charge of teacher's training for the Institute. And she had me come to two different workshops at the Institute to train me. And I really value her. Actually, this in July 12th, 13th, and 14th here in Milheim, Pennsylvania, Belinda's going to come here, and she and I together are going to be doing a workshop here in central Pennsylvania on retrieving the spiritual awakening experience. They have regular, if you go to Cuamungi, it's C-U-Y-A-M-U-N-G-U-E. CuamungiInstitute.com on the internet. They have a list of the workshops at the Institute. I'm supposed to be offering one at the 1st of August on animal spirit guides.
Do you have a book website as well for this book?
Excuse me, do I have a what?
Do you have a website for the book that we're talking about today?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. My website is Imaginal Mind, I-M-A-G-I-N-A-L-M-I-N-D, imaginalmind.net. I have my own website that lists the different events I'm doing, the workshops and the book signings and the radio talk shows and all the different activities I'm involved in.
Great. And they can get the book there as well, right?
Right. My book's available. It's from Barron Company, so it's a major publisher, Inner Traditions.
Okay.
So it's available from Amazon and from Barnes & Noble and from all the usual places, as well as you can get information about where you can get it on my website, too.
Okay, great.
The healing part of it, to me, is what's most important and what's really surprised me. I know as a therapist, I felt like I really had to be in charge to lead a person to healing. Using this trance, I'm just a drummer. I just suggest the posture, and the posture is what leads a person into trance. One of the very first examples I had, I think it must have been the fourth or fifth week of the group I started here at home. One woman, I was ready to read this one experience. We were using a divination experience. I'm not sure what her question was, and I didn't need to know. I don't need to know what the people are working on. It just happens. But let me read her experience. we used a divination posture, and her experience was, I began in a womb-shaped, den-like cave of branches. I was trying to figure out what animal I was, then I realized I was a very happy little girl, about 8 years old. I was alone, but happy and free. I was in a city on a sidewalk. The city was gray and ugly, but I felt so alive and happy. I walked up the road that turned into a wide bridge in a very industrial city setting. I stayed on the bridge a while, feeling happy, young, and free. Then I began to cross the bridge and realized it led into an enormous warehouse. I did not want to go in. I turned around, and behind me was a city, ugly and gray, but home. Then I got very, very sad. I became annoyed because I could not get off the bridge. I wanted to change visions, but that didn't work. I wanted to end the meditation, but I was still on the bridge. So I let out all emotions escape me, and I entered the warehouse. It was hell, a hellish landscape. I marched through and exited the other side. I was surprised to see the road continue on a beautiful, colorful landscape. I laid down in the grass. I knew it was beautiful, but I could not feel the same excitement. I was older now. That was just a direct, the card she wrote out afterwards. She came back a week later to our next session, and she announced she had not had a cigarette all week. She had been struggling to quit smoking, and this experience is what gave her permission. She knew that quitting was going to be hell, but in this case, the hell-like experience was just only those few moments it took her to walk through that warehouse. And she was a young, carefree, fun girl ahead of time, and with smoking gave her that feeling. Afterwards, she felt it was beautiful, but she somehow lost some of the excitement. She was older now. She sort of grew up out of the smoking. Mm-hmm. But the metaphorically, when it's like any dream, metaphorically, when you read that experience, you could see how it led her to quit smoking. Even though, I have to admit, I didn't know ahead of time that she had been struggling with smoking, though she didn't say specifically that that's what she was working on during the workshop. Mm-hmm. But over and over and over again, I've had such healing experiences. Another one was a woman who was suffering from depression from the empty nest. And her husband had died like 3 years before, and her daughter had just left to go away to college. And in her experience, she found herself underwater holding her daughter, and her daughter swam away very rapidly. Then she saw her mother walking from the distance towards her, and her mother announced to her, "Well, when you left, you swam faster than that." And that really gave her the permission to let go of her empty nest depression. Mm-hmm. And to me, it just really always amazes me when I hear how these heal, because I was not really part of what the struggle was that they were working on, or the fact that they were working on anything. But the postures and experiences do lead to healing.
Well, you know, a lot of the diseases that we suffer from, physical and emotional, are nothing more than states of mind. And I'm sure you're aware of the research done where they studied people in different states of multiple personalities. And so one personality might be depressed, another personality might be diabetic. You know, they had different things, physical and mental, but when they switched into another personality, those went away. And what I think is the static trance exercises allow you to transition from one state of mind to another. And, of course, you feel the energy doing that. You know, when you're very, very depressed, you're in a particular state of mind. And then when you're very happy, all you've done is shift your state of mind.
Right. And so the posture does trigger those changes in your state of mind. I think it's a very true way of saying it.
And then that affects your physical being. You know, your physical is a downward causation of the, you know, the mind and emotions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So I think that's how it works.
One of my in doing hypnosis, I used more of the approach of analytic hypnotherapy. A person would come to me and with a problem, and we would define the problem. Then hypnotically, I'd have the person take that problem back through time. I'd use hypnotic time regression or age regression, and we usually would go back to some point in childhood where that problem really developed. Maybe some conflict with a parent, or I remember one particular case. The college student I was working with remembered every time he was playing, his father would walk in, and he would just sigh, sort of like sigh in disgust, like he thought what the kid was doing was a waste of time. But, you know, it was abusive, but it really wasn't abusive as we would usually define abuse. But it had a huge effect on the son. But anyway, we would uncover these kind of issues. And then using hypnotic suggestions, I usually would say, have your adult self, with all the wisdom and understanding of your adult self, go back and help your younger self understand. Or help your younger self state or express what he or she needs. I use a whole series of different hypnotic experiences to help the person overcome that experience in childhood. And I find that the postures can do the same things. Instead of defining, spending time trying to define or put very clear words on what the problem is, a divination posture could do just that. If you ask the divination posture, what should I be working on? You'll get an answer. The answers are very likely just metaphoric. I mean, they're not maybe not clearly understood. They're metaphoric experiences. But the answer is there. The unconscious mind has a different kind of logic to it. It's not like our usual logic. It's usually in metaphor. In our usual frame of mind, our usual consciousness, past, present, and future are clearly defined. In dreams or in unconscious work, all three, past, present, and future, all could be now. The logic is quite different, but it's very important. So then I would have, hypnotically, I'd have the person go into their into the past or into their unconscious mind. Having a person going into the underworld, using one of the underworld postures, does that just as effectively. So I have a person lie down in one of the underworld postures and go into the underworld where they could find the answer. The third posture I would use probably 3 weeks later then would be the death-rebirth posture, where the old part of you dies and the new part is born. And I find those three postures, to me, I see a real parallel between using that and what I was doing in analytic hypnotherapy. So my next book, the book I'm working on now, basically looks at those that sequence of three postures, and I'm going to be giving many examples of how those three postures, when used in sequence that way, effects some healthy change and growth.
Well, I think that's great. At the end of the book, you go into some detail about what you think we're hooking into when we go into these trance states. I want to talk a little bit about, how we are, in third dimensional reality, we think everything's separate, but that at higher dimensional levels, that may not be the case. Would you like to address that? Because that actually sets the stage for, I think, why these things work so well.
I believe that Daniel Arouse or other people talk about you can't change by willpower. You have to change by imagination is the way Daniel Arouse talks about it. That willpower, there's things that contradict what you're thinking. I think the clearest example, the person who, let's talk about smoking for a minute. The person who wants to quit smoking is, I'm going to quit smoking. Mm-hmm. They don't face the other things that are coming out of their unconscious mind. They may be saying to themselves, you can't tell me what to do. Even though you're saying it to yourself, they've grown up with that attitude of resenting being told what to do. Or they may be saying to themselves, I can't gain weight. or if I quit smoking, I'm going to become irritable. They forget those kind of things, and they jump in, and as soon as they try to quit smoking, those kind of things start popping up. And pretty soon they give up and going back to smoking. The same kind of thing with weight loss. If you, I'm going to change something, but there's always those things that interfere that mm-hmm. come from your unconscious mind. And I think really you have to address those issues, those things you're saying to yourself that interfere. The person who is a bully. I mean, that's a pretty popular topic in school these days. The school bully. Mm-hmm. The bully probably is saying inside themselves, "I can't let anybody take advantage of me," or "If I don't stand up for myself, I feel foolish." And so those kind of unconscious statements that people say to themselves are what keep these behaviors going and drive them. And they basically have to be faced and reframed. And psychologically or consciously, when you try to do it, it just often does not work. Only when you are able to let it sink into your unconscious mind, even though when you dream about it or you look at it metaphorically in different ways, can you allow those things to allow yourself to change? And I think out of trance that happens. You very quickly go to those very. The trance experience is, even though it's metaphoric and it may seem bizarre at times, it's very much more who you are. It's a very honest statement about what's coming out of your unconscious mind. You're not deceiving yourself when you look at those experiences. So I think those experiences are very important to face. And one thing I've been doing is this book I'm working on now. Some of these people that I'm contacting, they had the experience maybe 2-3 years ago, and I'm asking them 2 or 3 years later, how do those experiences change their life? And when they start to think about it, they realize that their life did change, so even though they hadn't really thought about it. And then when I get them to think about it and why, what about that experience brought this about, we could uncover it. Sometimes it's maybe useful or interesting to uncover it, but I don't even know if that has to be done, that the change happened anyway without you really understanding how it happened. So I'm a strong believer in the power of the unconscious mind and how these experiences affect that.
One thing I'm seeing, and I'm going to just put it out to see if you've got, because I don't have the experience with this that you do, but what I'm seeing is that when you go into trance, you actually access energies that raise your energy to a higher level and then allow you to release things that no longer serve you, release energies that are disintegrating rather than integrating, and then changes spontaneously occur. I mean, to the conscious mind, they would seem spontaneous, but instead, if you do understand the metaphors and the allegory stories, that you can put it together, so your conscious mind understands what happened.
Mm-hmm. I think that's well said. I think that's very true.
So that really what we're doing is releasing, it allows us to release certain things that we can't release necessarily in a conscious mindset.
Right. I mean, so often there's things that consciously, I think maybe Carl Jung in his whole idea of the unconscious mind are opposites of what we believe. I'm not too sure if I mm-hmm. totally agree with that, but I think a lot of it's there. The unconscious mind is our shadow. It's just it's sort of the opposite
right, the
of a way we believe consciously. And if you just jumped in and said, "Okay, I'm going to try," it's okay. Again, I use the example of the tough guy who wants to fight back, and there's the other side of him would be the softy who is afraid to fight back. He might call the opposite side that, while unconsciously, that side might be much more effective in terms of how to relate to people and how to convince people of things, is to use that softer side. But the person, they feel just the opposite. He can't imagine how he could the effectiveness of that softer side. And as a therapist, if I would just sort of tell him that, it wouldn't register. It wouldn't make sense.
True.
But if I could lead him to that hypnotically, or in this case to a static trance, all of a sudden the light pops on. Well, I can, you know, the softer side can be every bit as effective as being the bully. It can be a lot more effective.
Right.
And so I think there's a lot of contradictions between what's in our unconscious mind and our conscious mind. I think there's other things there too, but Jung really refers to the unconscious side as to being the opposite of our conscious.
Yeah, and the programs that are running in the background in the unconscious or subconscious mind, rather, are a lot of times we're unaware of them, and a lot of times we don't even realize when they started running. Like you say, it might have been a childhood experience of embarrassment, mm-hmm. or fear or whatever that you've even forgotten. You don't even remember
right.
existed. So it's really difficult to access it consciously.
A lot of the abuse has been repressed. It's just too painful
right.
to face, so you forget about it. Another one is if you learn something pre-verbally before you even learn how to express it in words, the learning is there. It's a pre-verbal learning that you just may not ever think about. And so there's a little phrases that you learn as a child. One woman who's after her mother died, she kept going to the doctor. She kept running there every anything that went wrong. She went to the doctor. She had this huge mm-hmm. medical record. A real hypochondriac. When she got down to it, and she went back, she remembered her mother when her mother was dying. She was dying of cancer. Her mother told her, "You have to take care of yourself."
Mm-hmm.
And that little phrase that stuck with her from what her mother said, it wasn't really conscious several years later, but still it kept mm-hmm. her running to the doctor. And
right.
so when you uncover those kind of phrases that you use, it really does change things when you're able to face them and reframe them or rewrite them into something that's more healthy. And that could be done unconsciously through these postures.
So we're coming up on the last 10 minutes or so of our interview. Is there any message that you would like to leave our listeners in terms of these trances? Any overall message you want to get out?
You mentioned at the beginning getting back to the universal mind.
Yes, that would be good.
Let's go back to that just for a minute, because that's something in therapy I didn't think a whole lot about. Yes, I had mm-hmm. a couple different, I think twice I had someone go back to a past life. And mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily personally believe in past lives or reincarnation, but I believe that the experience was still very important. It was just another metaphoric experience of something that had a change. But I've had so many of these experiences using ecstatic trance.
Mm-hmm.
One common one is what I would call a mutual experience. Two people in the group having very, very similar experiences as if you're reading each other's mind.
Mm-hmm.
One example, one of my favorite examples, is I was watching Sarah, this one person in the group, as he went into trance, and I saw her break down into a shimmer of colors, and these colors raised up and down, then they started flying above our heads, and then out the door. And we went out the door, and we became trees on the hillside behind our house. What she saw the top of my head pop open, and she all saw all these colorful birds fly out. And the birds were flying mm-hmm. around the room, and they flew out the door. Then we went out the door and we became marble statues. how parallel the experiences were. They were different, but they were alike. And somehow that happened over and over and over again. I did this with a group of we have in our area here, OLLI, the Oxford Lifelong Learning Institute, where we get together senior citizens in different kinds of classes, some for cooking or hiking or whatever it might be. I've done ecstatic trance with two of these groups. And the first group, after during our sixth session, I had us break up into pairs. There was eight of us, and so there was four pairs. And I had the one person focus on the other person as they went into trance, just being aware of them, and how all four pairs, how the experiences were alike. My partner and I both, we had a lot of spiraling energy. The different things were happening, but everything was in spirals. Another couple, two women, they both became birds flying through the clouds. Then there was this husband and wife, and I had them paired. The husband, in his experience, was walking along the shore with his wife, holding her hand. And her experience was, my hand is getting so tired. And over and over again, these experiences almost invariable now that people within the group have very, very similar experiences. It's like we are, there's an energy beyond us. There's an awareness just beyond our own unconscious mind into what I call the universal mind, or which other writers, Jung might have called it the collective unconscious. Rupert Sheldrake refers to it as the morphic field, this energy field that holds all of us together. Or Irving Laszlo would call it the Akashic field. But there's this belief that there's this energy field out there that has all information. The second book, the publisher accepted, but it hasn't come out yet. It'll probably come out this next year from now, is The Return of Balder. I had one experience where I went back to early Germany, about 6,000 B.C., and the person I met in the experience, I really felt like was an ancestor. So I made it a point of going back to my ancestors. I mean, I just would sort of say, that's where I want to go. And I collected 40 or 50 of these, what I really felt like were ancestral experiences. This book is about these experiences of Scandinavia, of going back to when they believed in the mother goddess, then the transformation into the Viking era of the masculine, testosterone violence. And I think now we're going into a new era where we are about to reclaim this more feminine, matriarchal energy that, to me, is much more healing than the confrontive energy that we're experiencing now. So the book is really about that energy, but about going back and communing with my ancestors. So I really do feel
I just want to insert that I was part of a group of women who Stephanie Marone was our editor, put together a book called Goddess Shift: Women Leading for a Change. And, my part's on spirituality and medicine, but the book has Oprah, Michelle Obama, Angelina Jolie, Madonna. J.K. Rowling wrote a chapter on the power of persistence because Harry Potter was rejected 50 times. And it's just women from all branches, politics, law, Olympic tennis players, every aspect of human endeavor are in this book. And so that's kind of a part of that feminine energy coming forward to transform things. That I think you're right. I think that is happening. And you see a lot of conferences and other books being written on that topic. It's
exactly.
All about balance.
We're really going
really.
Into a new age. We're going into a new age.
It's about balance.
Very exciting.
Right. You have to have
our earth survives.
You have to have the masculine and you have to have the feminine to balance it, And if you get too far over in one area, you get suffering. I mean, it's the middle path. And so I think this is really good. I think the trances allow you to see for yourself through through the stories that are told, parts of your life that need to be more in balance so that you'll become healthier. I think it's when we get out of balance that, I mean, look at the environment today. It's way out of balance, you know, all the chemicals we're exposed to. If people don't think that has an effect, you know, especially in autoimmune disease and cancer, they're just not, I mean, they're not reading the medical literature, you know. So things out of balance cause suffering.
Exactly.
It just does.
You're so right.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to contact me, I'm more than happy to share these ideas with people and invite them to workshops or have them on my mailing list so they could get to me through imaginalmind.net. That's my website, and that sort of I'd be more than happy to talk to anybody who wants to take this farther.
Well, great. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We've been talking
with
Dr. Nicholas Brink, a delightful conversation on the power of aesthetic trance, practices for healing, spiritual growth, and accessing the universal mind. Good luck on your next book, too, Dr. Brink. We hope to have you back on for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Susan.
Okay, next week we have 2012, We're Creating Your Own Shift by Hunt Henian. And then Dr. Amit Goswami is back on the 8th of June. God is Not Dead, What Quantum Physics Tells Us About Our Origins and How We Should Live. And then Dr. Eric Love returns on the 15th of June, Healing the Heart and Mind, The Importance of Healing the Emotional Component in Order to Heal the Physical. Again, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.